This is Ed Driscoll for PajamasMedia.com, and we're talking with Colonel Austin Bay, co-author of the perennially best-selling A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, syndicated columnist, frequent contributor to PajamasMedia.com and PJTV.com, and formerly host of Blog Week in Review, one of Pajamas Media's very first podcasts. And he's the author of a new book published by Palgrove Macmillan titled Ataturk, Lessons in Leadership from the Greatest General of the Ottoman Empire, with a foreword by General Wesley Clark. And Austin, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Great to be with you, Ed.
Austin, we might as well start at the very beginning with a very obvious question. Who was Mustafa Kemal Ataturk?
Well, Mustafa Kemal was a young man born in Salonika, Macedonia in 1880, 1881. There's some question as to the exact year. Salonika, Macedonia at that time, Ed, was part of the Ottoman Empire, which was a multi-ethnic, multi-religious empire, but it was ruled by the Ottoman Turks from their capital, Constantinople. And the Ottoman Turks are Sunni Muslims. And that was part of what was called Rumelia, that Ottoman Macedonia, meaning that was the Rome, because when the Turks invaded Anatolia, which is the primary area where modern Turkey is located, they ran into the Byzantine Greeks. And recall that the Byzantine Empire was the eastern half of the Roman Empire, so they referred to the lands where the Byzantines lived as Rum or Rome, and then that name became applied to when they took over the provinces in southeastern Europe or in the Balkans. Well, that's where Kemal Ataturk was born, in Salonika, which is Greece's Thessalonica. And he wanted to become a soldier. He went into the Turkish military school system and ultimately served in a series of wars that led up to World War One. I will mention them because they are really the three little bangs that kicked off World War One: Turco-Italian War of 1911 to 1912, which most folks have not heard of, but I will tell you it sets up the First Balkan War, which some people have heard of, and that's the Balkan League versus the Ottoman Turks, and then the Second Balkan War, and then right after that we have World War One. And Kemal Ataturk is most famous, I suppose, for, at least in the West, the victory at Gallipoli. Ataturk's 19th Division is the unit that stopped the Australians in their attempt to break through over the Gallipoli Peninsula, climb the mountains, and then come in and attack the Turkish forts that protected the Dardanelles in the great attempt in 1915 to breach the Dardanelles so that the British Commonwealth, if the intent was to knock Turkey out of the war. Turkey was on the side of the Central Powers, Austria-Hungary and Imperial Germany. After World War One and the end of the Ottoman Empire, Ataturk was part of a group of Turkish nationalists who objected to a peace treaty that really sliced what was left of Turkey itself into classical central Turkey, Anatolia, into essentially economic satrapies for the Western powers. And he launched a Turkish nationalist movement, which ultimately, after a war with Greece, creates foundations of the modern Turkish Republic, which actually connects us to 2011, even though I mentioned a moment ago 1911 and this obscure Turco-Italian war of 1911-1912. 2011, the era of Arab Springs. One way to frame Arab Spring is, how do you modernize a culturally Islamic society? And Kemal Ataturk, when he became president of the Turkish Republic, organized the Turkish Republic in 1923, is the only man to ever really successfully modernize a culturally Islamic society, particularly in terms of establishing a parliamentary democracy. So I guess that's a little rundown on my book, even though I will say for readers, I primarily focus on Ataturk's military career, roughly 1905 to 1923. So this is a military history. But Ataturk is such an extraordinary character. You cannot separate his military gifts from his political gifts. And I say that you can see in his military career the same kind of skills that he exhibits as the founder of the Turkish Republic. And you can make the case, and I'm one of the people who makes it, is that Ataturk was really the 20th century's most successful revolutionary. It certainly wasn't Vladimir Lenin, wasn't Mao Zedong, wasn't Ho Chi Minh, wasn't Gandhi. I think it was Ataturk, and we're seeing, you know, that it's not that his legacy is all settled inside contemporary Turkey, because they're moderate Islamists that are testing that secular legacy that of Ataturk, but he certainly established what has grown into a modern state.
Well, and we'll come back to those who were pushing against the modernization of Turkey. But how did Ataturk acquire his military genius?
Well, Ed, in some degree, I believe Ataturk is one of those unusual people that's got a natural aptitude, and he meets, and I point this out actually in the introduction and pick it up a couple of other times in the book. I talk about Karl von Clausewitz, the author of On War, the great Prussian military theorist. I talk about his chapter on military genius in the book On War, and go through some of the descriptions that Clausewitz, some of the characteristics that Clausewitz says are attributes that you would see in someone who is really a gifted military leader. Now, understand that when Clausewitz is writing this, the huge figure looming over Clausewitz was Napoleon, and you've seen the results, the good, the bad, the terrors of the Napoleonic era, but there's no doubt that Napoleon was an extraordinary master of the battlefield. And Clausewitz attempts to abstract what those characteristics are, how they are utilized as well, and how we see them expressed. And I go through some of the Clausewitz's discussion, and I said, take a look at what Ataturk did as a soldier. He was a successful leader at what we call a tactical level. Now, that's military jargon, but that's leading people immediately in a combat situation. We think of it a platoon, 30 people, or a company, 100 people, or a battalion, 500 to 600 people, or a regiment. He was a successful direct tactical leader, and that was in the Turco-Italian War of 1911-1912. He was a successful operational leader, and that's, you know, you've got tactical aspects of it, but you're also moving larger bodies of troops around, battalions, regiments or brigades, and divisions, even corps. And he certainly displayed an extraordinary operational, tactical and operational capability at Gallipoli, because in the initial battle with the Australians right after the invasion, he's directly involved in the fighting right there at the critical point in the critical battle on the day of the Gallipoli invasion. But he also ends up commanding an entire front there. He ends up commanding a corps and then an army on the Eastern Front, both fighting the Russians and then fighting the British in Palestine. And then in some ways the most remarkable campaign was the campaign in Anatolia against the Greeks, the Greek offensive to Ankara, where you see a remarkable capacity to understand what the effects are of the lengthening Greek supply line, the limitations of his own soldiers, limitations of some of his own commanders, what the terrain means for both his troops and for the Greeks. And at the same time, he's waging a political war, a political struggle not only on the international arena against the great powers and a political diplomatic struggle with the Greeks, but an extraordinary political struggle on what is a nascent domestic political scene inside Turkey with their own grand assembly and the other power blocks that exist within the Turkish nationalist movement. And he masters them all. And it can sound on the point of being a hagiography, but no, he pulled it off, which is why, let me tell a quick story myself on my own interest in Ataturk. I read one of the early biographies, about 35 years ago. And when I finished it, I wondered, I said, good gosh, look at all the levels of not just the military but political accomplishment of this fellow. Why don't we hear more about him? And after doing this book on his military career, but also tying it in ultimately to the modernization process that he initiates in Turkey, I think, well, maybe I've added something so that here's something we know more about the man. And here's another introduction to whom, to a person I think to be a major 20th century figure.
What would Ataturk, after all of the reforms that he brought to Turkey, make of the statement by, and I know I'm going to screw the gentleman's name up, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, now Prime Minister of Turkey, who infamously said in 1995, quote, "Democracy is like a streetcar. When you come to your stop, you get off," unquote.
Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Very good. Very close. Well, Mr. Erdogan is now Prime Minister. I'm not sure how much time we have. I can give you a rundown to explain who the players are in at least a brief summary of who the players are in contemporary Turkish politics. But Prime Minister Erdogan is actually head of a party called the Justice and Development Party, the AKP. Its roots are in earlier Islamist parties that were banned by the Turkish judiciary or jailed by the Turkish army acting as a, or Turkish military acting as the protectors of Turkish democracy. However, when the Justice and Development Party was organized, they claimed that they were committing themselves to democracy. At the same time, that was subsequent to the statement that you quoted. The Republican People's Party, or the CHP, is really the heir to Ataturk's Secularist Party. Unfortunately, the CHP and its associates got terribly corrupt at the 1980s, certainly in the 1990s. And what brought the AKP to power was this argument that does have some legitimacy, which is that moral values provide a moral bulwark against corruption. And we're going to clean up the mess of Turkish politics. And that's the election, that's the 2002 election. And they win. Over the last few years, Mr. Erdogan has managed to even increase his parliamentary control of parliament. There was an election just this past June where the AKP did extremely well. They didn't take the overwhelming majority that they'd sought. And understand you're talking to someone who has been a critic of Mr. Erdogan, me, watched what's going on, and placing myself, if I was in a Turkish, I would be a member of the Republican People's Party. But I have also noticed this, which puts me at odds with other critics of Mr. Erdogan. I have noticed some sobering effects of power. In other words, realizing that one of the most greatest gifts that contemporary Turkey has is its secular government, is its vibrant society that's not being destroyed because everything is being determined by clerics, or same thing with going with a priestly class telling you what you can and cannot do. Turkey has a extraordinarily successful economy. I think they've got the 16th largest GDP now, somewhere in there. They're in the top 20. And Mr. Erdogan has, in some ways, hooked his own political wagon to economic success. And even though Turkey's trying to, you know, has globalized its economy, it still trades heavily with Europe, relies on its good political connections with the United States and other democracies. Now, here is something else I have noticed, despite Mr. Erdogan's anti-Israeli rhetoric, which, of course, got extremely harsh after the Gaza flotilla. Remember that, Ed?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Last year, I mean, huge thing. I mean, we covered that extremely well on Pajamas, I believe, on certainly things on PJ TV, several shows on that. But the the rhetoric is one thing, but huge trade, like significant amount of trade going on between Israel and Turkey. It's increased over the last decade. I'm doing this off the top of my head. Everybody can go Google it. But I believe it's somewhere between $4 and $5 billion a year now. And I also note, and here's the thing that really stunned me, Ed. We're recording this in October of 2011, in the middle of September of last month, 2011, right after the Islamist-inspired assaults on the Israeli embassy. Here comes Prime Minister Erdogan into Egypt. And he says on an Egyptian television talk show host, "I hope you will have a secular democracy. I am not a secular man, but I am the prime minister of a secular democracy." And then he repeats that in Libya, and he repeats that in Tunisia. That is one of the strongest things that can be said as a providing an outside encouragement to liberalizers and modernizers and those three critical Arab Spring revolutionary countries, particularly in Egypt. And he said it. And that sounds a little bit different, actually sounds a lot different, Ed, than Recep Tayyip Erdogan of 15 years ago. So do I believe that Prime Minister, do I trust Prime Minister Erdogan? No. I do think this is the place where we need aggressive and public U.S. diplomacy. None of this leading from behind about the Arab Springs. America, democracy has prestige. The United States has prestige. If you have a leadership, and I'm taking a shot at President Obama here. They have the declinist ideology pushing their foreign policy. Oh, and the various apology tours that President Obama has conducted. No, we need to be involved. We need to be engaged, pushing democratic values, supporting liberalizers and modernizers. And I'll tell you what, we can make common cause with the Turks and Prime Minister Erdogan. If he's going to say, "I am not a secular man, but I am the prime minister of a successful secular democratic government," Prime Minister Erdogan, let that be you. Let Turkey continue with those values. We're going to support you, and let's see what we can do to try to meet the guaranteed threat coming, a subversive threat coming from Islamist extremists in Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia. So that, I mean, there's an opportunity here to use what I'll call Ataturk 2.0, because this is not the same situation that obtains in 1923 yet.
Right.
But
sure.
It has the same kind of orientation towards a secular democracy, where you can be whatever you want to be. You want to be a Muslim, you want to be a Christian, you want to be an agnostic, you want to be a Hindu, because that is the strongest political system for maintaining political and economic creativity. And that really is probably, modern is a tough word to define, but that's permitting the creative and creative adaptation is democracy's genius.
And Austin, just to slowly start to wrap things up, you have some rather prominent future speaking engagements coming up.
I'll be giving a speech in Washington right now. I think it is scheduled for November the 18th. We are recording this on October the 14th. It could change, but it will be in Washington. I'll be speaking about Ataturk's legacy in 2011. One of the sponsors is the Ataturk Society of America, and that is, like I said, that is November 18th, which is a Friday. I will also be on a panel, giving a presentation on this panel, on December the 6th at the United Nations in New York. That's a panel on Ataturk's legacy, and this is a non-political, but for historians done recent work on Ataturk. That is one of the sponsors is Turkey's UN mission. And again, that is the afternoon of December the 6th. And I know both of those events are open to the public. If you're in Washington at that time or in New York, please come by.
And you're also going to be on C-SPAN this coming weekend.
Oh,
right?
I guess I ought to mention that. Thanks, Ed. C-SPAN is going to be covering the Texas Book Festival. They have done that in the past. The Texas Book Festival is October 22nd and 23rd. Here in Austin, Texas, where I live, and from 3 to 4 p.m. Central Time, C-SPAN will be where I will be on a panel on Arab Spring from the book festival. So that will be that will be broadcast by C-SPAN. So check that out. It's going to have two Arabists on there, James Zogby and Robin Wright, and but they both have books out this year. And then I will be there as talking about Ataturk's influence, Ataturk 2.0, I guess is the way I'm going to describe it, because it's not 1923 yet, it's 2011, but you, as I said, you still have the need to focus on what the rewards are of a secular society.
This is Ed Driscoll for PajamasMedia.com, and we've been talking with Colonel Austin Bay. Austin is the author of the new book, Ataturk, Lessons in Leadership from the Greatest General of the Ottoman Empire, with a foreword by General Wesley Clark. And Austin, thank you once again for taking the time to talk with us today.
Delightful, Ed. Thank you.